the front row.
The one.
I didn't want to draw that, but I'm here.
Actually, it was church service first, right? So one of the ministers was supposed to read the scripture, but he'd had a little bit to drink. So when he got up to read the scripture, he read it, and then he started preaching.
Please all squeeze together.
And he wasn't supposed to preach, you know.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And he began preaching by saying, "Where do we go from here?" It's about that speed, right? And the ministers behind him were doing the call response thing. That's right, tell the truth, you know. Shut up and sit down. And kicking him in the back of the leg so that he would, or nudging him in the back of the leg so he'd stop, and he wouldn't stop. And he just kept preaching and preached for about 10 minutes with all this going on. And I could see it because I was behind the row of ministers. So I enjoyed that.
Thank you. Well, I think we have our full
every
group
time
here. I think we have our full group of, and our topic for this breakout group originally was the successes and challenges of SCOPE, but from a personal, like what happened in my county. Now, some of you have already shared that, I've already talked about that, and are ready to talk more about how it impacted you personally, and that's what we are very, so we can do a little more successes and challenges of whatever any unsaid things you have to say, and we'll do a quick round of that where we just keep it really to a couple minutes each person. Once again, checking in by saying your name for the transcription, because this is an audio transcription. And then saying what you have to say in your summation statements about successes or challenges in your project. And then we'll do a next round, and Sister Joy here will figure out how much time we have left and divide it some, you know, reasonably evenly, like everybody has 5 minutes or everybody has 7 minutes or what we have, and then she'll give you a two-minute warning so that we can be relaxed and not hyperventilating or thinking about when's it going to be my turn to do this. And so that is what we're going to do, and I will kick it off very briefly. This is Maria Gittin. At that time, my name was Joyce Bryans. I worked in Wilcox County, Alabama, which was one of the most violently segregated counties in the entire South, and many, many people in SCLC and SNCC compared it by saying, it's just as bad as Mississippi. And people said, you know, it's like as if you had enlisted in the military and some people went to Fort Benning and somebody went to Vietnam and you got sent to Vietnam. So I'm not going to dwell at length on that because I have, in fact, written a book about it in great detail. But I want to go to the successes and failures of the project. And I think one of the most important things that I heard this weekend from Bernard Lafayette and from other speakers was whether or not you registered a lot of people in your county, and we registered 500 in Wilcox before the act passed, which is a pretty significant number considering that people who were trying to register were being mistreated in every possible number of the ways that you're all familiar with. That what we did, it was like we were a launch pad for people to have the information, the courage, the tools that they needed, and some people stayed in the county. A lot of people left our SCOPE project, but some people stayed. And our SCLC leader, Dan Harrell, who was also a director of 7 counties in Alabama, are there other people in the room who had Dan Harrell as one of your county directors?
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. He stayed. He ended up living there, and lived there and continued organizing for the next 7 years. When people got thrown off their properties, he was able to bring in federal anti-poverty money. So a lot of the people who had lost their jobs or lost their tenant farms were able to get training to become home health aides. So there was a tremendous amount of good. Now, if I was Jose Williams, I would take total credit for this. Like SCOPE did all this. But really what it was is we were part of a bigger fabric. So I consider that our project had many, many challenges, not the least of which was all of the internal dissension that many of you are familiar with and the external harassment, being shot, going to jail. But I still feel proud of our work more today than I did back then when I felt fairly discouraged, because in reflection, I see what a vital part we were of it. So that's about was that about 3 or 4 minutes, Joy?
That was 4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. So about the same of doing the success challenge, your perspective on and please say your name and your county. Yeah.
My name is, we'll go this way. My name is Dick Klausner. I was in Crenshaw County, Alabama, with Bruce, was the person there, and I think that was his first time in the field outside of Selma itself. There were 5 or 6 of us, I'm trying to think, 5. Crenshaw County, unlike Wilcox County, is very small. The county seat was, I think, 1,200 people.
If you could just speak up, I know that it's hard for people at that end to hear.
That's right. A very small county. The biggest city is 1,200 people, and then there were...
Okay, I'm just checking to make sure the recorder is here.
Yes,
we're okay. All right.
That was Bruce, who was in the same county. In terms of successes, it was very difficult to get people registered. We did not have huge numbers. We were the county due south of Lowndes County. As I said, very rural. We spent a lot of time in the field. Near the middle of the time we were there, kind of counter-directive, we did sort of some direct action in the sense of going up and integrating, if we could, the bus station, cafe, and some other places, which did involve some activity that was unpleasant. We all ended up, rolling around on the ground curled up, and we also ended up in a car chase, which we all reflect on at great length, which is probably, in retrospect, just another one of those events. To sum that up, I'm not sure, I've never been back to Brantley or Luverne, the two towns in the county. I would like to go back. In many respects, I thought Scope did more for me than we did for the county. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, maybe makes it one of the reasons I'm pretty reticent to talk about that time. Mm-hmm. I know there are different perspectives and approaches for other people, but I've spent very little time talking about it to either friends or neighbors. But it did have some effect on me in a big way. It's basically, I spent the rest of my life, I've been a criminal defense lawyer for 40 years.
For 4 or 40?
40. And during that time, entire time representing indigent defendants, I come from a county which is a town and a state which is predominantly white. I come from Iowa, but we have a very substantial population of indigent people, many of whom are black, who are escaping from Chicago or St. Louis or whatever, and they're coming to small cities in Iowa, and Iowa's a very homogeneous place.
Okay. and we're actually also going to do a second round where you can talk
okay,
more
yeah,
about...
Okay, yeah, I'll stop there. I'm just saying, it did affect...
I want you to be able to give the fullness of that.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just simply say, that was my first 40 years, and then after I retired, I've been doing nothing but affordable housing. So it seems to me to be a pattern, and I think Scope was, I was 18, freshman in college. So that's where I lay my experiences there down.
Thank you. Great.
My name is Boyd Faust. I was kind of unique, I guess, among Scope volunteers that summer. I was born and raised in Macomb, Mississippi.
Oh.
And the previous summer, Macomb, during the COFO summer, was the bombing capital of the world, as some of you may remember. And I was home from college that summer, and I remember that, and that was very formative to me in really deciding that it was time to do something besides sitting on the sidelines. I was at school at the University of Notre Dame, and I was the only person who came, very conservative Catholic school, and there really was not much support for social justice issues in those days. That's changed a lot, I know. I came pretty much by myself to orientation, and ended up being sent to Savannah along with 11 other people. It was never clear to us why Savannah needed 12 people.
Yeah, that's a big group.
But the original group that went there, of the original group, there were only six of us. Four young men from Maryknoll Seminary in Illinois, myself, and Iris Geller Rubin, who is here today. And as others came in late, it seemed that they got shipped to Savannah. Savannah had been very heavily worked. If you remember the story of Hosea and the Chatham County Crusade for Voters, and there were a lot of times when we weren't quite sure what we were to do. Now, this was not really the fault of the local leadership, although at the time we thought it was all their fault. At orientation, we were told, oh, the local people will train you how to do voter registration. When we got to Savannah, the local leaders are saying, well, go do it, and we don't know how to do it. And it was that kind of an issue. Iris, the gentleman from the seminary, had to go back to school in mid-July. And Iris and I left at that time to be sent to Americus. So my second assignment during the summer was in Sumter County, Americus, where I arrived 2 days before the election in which the four women were arrested. I'm sure many of you know the Sumter story. I was only in Americus for 2 weeks because I was a stupid kid. And as you remember, I was different because I wasn't just a northern outside agitator. I was a traitor. I was a traitor. I was a southern boy, southern white boy here doing this. So I was a target. I didn't know it at the time, but I was a target all along the way. And at a demonstration one day on the 31st of July when some black guys were being beaten up by a white crowd, I was the stupid 21-year-old kid who went over to the Georgia State Patrolman and said, well, what do you think you're going to do about this? And he clubbed me over the head, and I got sent back to Atlanta, where I spent the rest of the summer in the Freedom House with Jose, after which I was then, as staff, sent on to Hopewell, Virginia. So it was an interesting summer. It's very hard to say what the success or failure in Sumter County was. After the Voting Rights Act, there were like 1,500 people who were registered in Sumter County. Again, this is that place where someone spoke this morning about federal registrars, and Sumter County was right at the top of the list, and the County Board of Registrars just decided the day before the Voting Rights Act was passed to appoint two black registrars.
Wow.
And people flooded in. They were all registered in 3 days. 1,500 people were registered. And I'll stop there.
Just
that has to be said to be a success.
Yeah.
But there were so many outside people who had come to Savannah at Hosea's behest at that time that it's hard to pin it on who was responsible. SNCC was there. CLC was there. Folks from Macon were there, people came up from Albany, all the other folks from Savannah came, and there's some people like Carol who came from other places around. But it was a fascinating event. I don't really know what happened in Savannah because most people did not go back there after the Americas. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Boyd.
Hi, I'm Mitch Maroney. I came with the group from St. Mary the Woods College and two other students from Indiana State University. So there were six of us, four students from the woods, two students from Indiana State, that was six students, and two faculty members, Sister Mary Jean, who was a history professor, and Sister Alma Louise, who was a biology professor. So as you probably know, when Dr. King sent out this letter, the college president got it, she shared it, and immediately some of us decided that this was something good to do. The letter came probably in late winter or early spring of 65, and by May, a team was already formed. I think it's a little bit interesting to look at the background of the team and the state of Indiana, just in terms of a perspective, because Indiana, you could tell by today by their homophobic legislation that's going on currently, was a strikingly conservative state in many ways. And yet, curiously, Birch Bayh, who was a very progressive senator, was the senator from Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I had no idea when I chose that school or how I landed there about this, you know, conservative side of Indiana. I was from Western Pennsylvania, and I had a Catholic education, most of it by choice. And so the only reason I ended up at St. Mary of the Woods was because I was a country bumpkin, and I was afraid, intimidated to go to a large university, so I was looking for small schools that had both a journalism and a drama program. So St. Mary of the Woods College was the ones that did it, and so off I went. And when I got to Indiana, I was shocked to find out how conservative the state was. And I had no idea, because my Catholic background was pretty much influenced by a lot of social justice, so I couldn't understand how you could be a Catholic and discriminate. That's how naive I was. But in any case, when we got out of our training in Atlanta, and there's something important that has not been mentioned before in terms of our success. Our professors and the whole college felt very strongly that in terms of this political education, that literacy was an important part of it. So our team actually studied with the Indiana University professor, and I've forgotten his name, but I can probably find it, who had a fairly new literacy training project he was starting, but it focused on adults. Now, what we did know, part of the discrimination was that the literacy test actually had reading passages. And so some people who attempted in some states to register had memorized passages, but then they would change the passages.
Right.
But nevertheless, we took to heart a literacy 1 minute?
2 minutes.
A literacy aspect. And so one important part that has not been mentioned is that the nuns, and I participated too, in the evenings we had adult literacy classes. Mm-hmm. And so it was actually quite striking, quite remarkable that we had 50, 60, 70-year-olds coming in there, and for getting them to read for the first time was a remarkable experience. And so we felt that the school that SNCC had actually established, we built on and made some changes, but we felt that that was really incorporating an important part of the community to address literacy tied into poverty. As for voter registration, I don't know how successful we truly were, and maybe not so much, because when we got there, SNCC had a well-oiled organization, and they had been working on voter registration for some time. And they told us then that the people who were not registered were hardcore. But yet we had 18-year-olds at the school and 16, 17-year-old boys who thought that, you know, the older girls, 18 and 19-year-olds, they were more interested in that. But nevertheless, we did try to work on education. We had some pre-K kids, and we had adults who couldn't read. So all over the map with our education. And then part of our day would be voter registration. Sometime I want to address the issue of the conflict that was there with SNCC and SCOPE, because there are some serious misunderstandings. I do want to speak about that. But for right now, I feel that, yes, it definitely influenced the rest of my life. I became a high school English teacher, but I did come from a progressive household, so I built on that.
I want to say that The groups were to have 7 people each in them, and I am personally thrilled that you all wanted to be magnetized to group number 1. But it is going to cut into our discussion time somewhat. So one of the things is, if you have already gone on record saying what county you were in and what your background was, and it's already been recorded, unless you feel the need, because some people do, and I totally respect that, if you want to declare that, to apportion your time, because it's possible that we won't have time for a second go around, although we have another 45 minutes, but we now have, we went from 7 to 13 people in our room, and everybody who wants to say something, we want to give you time to say something. So I just want to be advised, I guess I would say. Yeah, thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm Jim Herman. I'll try to just give you bullet points and we'll see what happens. I was stationed, or not stationed.
No, that's what we always say.
Worked in Allendale, South Carolina. Allendale, for what it was worth, was the hometown of the sitting governor and also the hometown of Mendel Rivers. But it was a majority black county and with very few people registered to vote. So it was primed for stuff to happen. I also was 25 years old. I wasn't old, but I was the oldest of our particular group. There was about 8 of us had signed up to be assigned there, and but Jose sent 3 of them to Alabama. So in any case, it was very nice setup for working in the community, but we could only register people to vote one day.
Right.
And in July, we had about 200 people show up. 30 got registered, broke all records on their books, but we were, of course, very disappointed. We tried to get open more days. I say that quickly, and I'll go to the next bullet point. So our next day of real work was going to be August 2nd. Dr. King happened to say on August 1st, he's going to start filling up the jails. Before that, we weren't confrontational or anything. And what happened then was I called up Atlanta and said, we're going to have 300 people at least here. And he says, if they show up, give me a call. So, and in the meantime, I had invited our sponsor, a Baptist minister from Detroit, to come down and visit us that time because it was going to be a work day. And our spiritual sponsor, we were all from the Newman Club, Catholic priest also coming down to visit. So they were present. And some friends of mine who had been originally sent to Alabama also might as well get here. It's going to be a work day. So I call Atlanta. Atlanta says, you got these people. They sent out 4 probes that arrived about noon. They, of course, took over the decision-making. We still ran the day and everything, so the people all thought I was the leader because I was doing the talking. And our regular way of operation just simply was one of the things I did, maybe because I was 25 years old or whatever. But the Leon Hall, at 5 o'clock when they told us to disperse, and we would have dispersed on our own, said, we're not going anywhere. Immediately, they closed in, arrested me and Lance Nelson, who happened to be 6'5", another guy they thought was the leader. They didn't grab the SCLC people yet. They didn't know who they were. Fortunately for me, I hope this is quick, just to give you a background, because I want to say a couple other little things. They also came back and told the crowd that if anybody didn't leave, they were going to be arrested. They at least got a chance to see it. Fortunately for me, both of the clerics, 4 of the girls that worked with us, and a number of some local people in that did get arrested, and so we all wound up in jail. Very quickly, I was released at 2 o'clock in the morning, and SCLC told me to go with the 4 women and escort them. And we got bailed out. I'm trying to say this very quickly. We had a guy, Webster was his name, Clemson chaplain, had working with the Justice Department. I don't think it was the Civil Rights Division, but it was another division. We had met with him a little bit earlier. He bailed us out. Now, he worked for the federal government. The New York Times the next day said, U.S. government bails out civil rights workers. They don't do that, of course. Webster was fired. There's more to the story, but I'll skip that.
1 minute.
And I'll just go. We had demonstrations in that for a week or so. SCLC told me they thought it was too dangerous for me to stay in town. So I went back to Atlanta. Atlanta sent me to America's, where the Klan was marching, and then on to Birmingham for their conventions. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more, obviously, to fill in between, but that's just a start. And the only other thing I'll say is that whole experience was life-changing for me, and I worked as a volunteer also with SCLC in Chicago the next year.
Wow. Thank you, John. Yeah.
My name's Kathy Duffy. I was in Greene County, Alabama, summer of 65, with a group from the University of Illinois in Urbana, about 6, 7, 8 of us. And we worked with local leaders there, who were all ministers, which I found interesting when I got there.
If you could just put a little bit up. Raise your voice. Sorry. They couldn't hear you.
So that group of us from the University of Illinois, none of us went to the Atlanta orientation. We had an orientation, I think, on campus of our own, and then we headed directly to Greene County, which is 82% black. It's about 30 miles from Bourbonland. And our work was centered in Utah. The county seat is spelled E-U-T-A-W. Utah. And I lived out in the countryside in Forkland, Alabama, and the home of the Robinsons. I hope they're doing well today. I've never been able to stay in touch with them for many years now. But one thing I didn't know that I may have learned this weekend was that maybe there was somebody out there guarding me all night long, every night that I was. I hope not, but now I feel I need to know that. It was a pretty isolated farm, but I never got the sense of anyone was guarding me. I was the only one there from our group. Thomas Gilmer was the local leader, along with Reverend Branch. And Gilmer is just 3-4 years older than me, but certainly, to me, he was like 30 years older. And without his leadership, we couldn't have accomplished anything there. But he really set us up, put us to work, gave us organized work to do, and we were very proud of our organized work. So I think somebody in the last couple of days has made the remark that one thing we accomplished as SCOPE was to help mobilize the local people and movement. We didn't mobilize them, but by our going to mass meetings and our going to voter registration, going out in the county, meeting people, and then going to the mass meetings where we met more people, just our presence there, I think, gave people a different sense about what the possibilities were. It certainly also, you know, made them more afraid in some cases. So it was a two-edged sword. At the same time, we were happy to think that we're doing something good. We were also worried that maybe we were doing something dangerous for the people that we lived with and that we were working with. And as I heard a couple of times, y'all got up and left, you know. And well, we did, didn't we? We went home. I went back to college, finished my senior year, and never stopped worrying and wondering, well, what happened to folks that were still there facing the Klan? But now I know, and as I learned, one really good thing came out of that experience. So I'm going to talk about that, which is Reverend Thomas Gilmer becoming sheriff of Greene County, the first black sheriff since Reconstruction. And a young enough man, I think he was only 23 or 24 at that time, 25, and he was from there, so that he could stay sheriff for like 20-some years or something.
30 years. Yeah.
And then. And he was known as the sheriff without a gun because he was a Martin Luther King nonviolent civil rights worker and a minister, and he believed in violence. Could you add to that?
No, 1 minute. Oh. I was just going to let you know you have 1 minute.
Well, I just thought that was one of the most important things that we could do, was to maybe seed the ground a little bit so that could become a victory for that whole county. And imagine how the people would feel after being abused and oppressed by a white sheriff for so many years, to finally have somebody that when he pulled him over, you know, on the street, wasn't going to kill him. Like, really, I thought that was a big victory. So that's all.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My name's Neil Reichlein. I was in Macon, and our group was from UCLA. We were a large group. I think at various times we had 18, 20 people. Not all from UCLA. We had some other people join us. So I think we got sent to we got sent to Macon because it was not a rural area. We were a big urban university, and we probably did better at Macon than we would have in a rural area. And Macon was interesting because it was, there wasn't just a black community and a white community. There was black communities, four or five of them, in various parts of the town. So we split our group up, and people were stationed in various communities there. I was, even though, quite honestly, I didn't remember this, I was evidently in charge of voter registration.
I can understand that.
That's what everybody tells me. So. But I do remember, once I remembered it, that that getting everything organized and getting people working in various parts of the city and having cars assigned to pick people up and taking them into Macon was complicated because you had to go to one courthouse to register for local elections and another courthouse to register for other elections.
Wow.
And getting all that organized was really something. And that's evidently how I spent most of my time. Though what I remember is occasionally being knocking door to door in rural areas, more rural parts of the town, and working on the streets downtown, which we did a lot of. Our office was located above a liquor store on, I think, Cotton Avenue, from what I remember.
Convenient.
And so we did a lot of work just off the streets, and one of the courthouses was diagonally across the street from us, so we could grab somebody there and march them right over. That was the quickest way to do things. I'm not sure, I really don't know how we managed to register the number of people we did. I know at a certain point we had to deal with a literacy test. And I know we spent some time finding someone who we thought could pass it. And we did. We had three copies of the three tests that they used. And we found a wonderful woman who could learn all that stuff, and she passed the test.
Wow.
But at other times, there wasn't a literacy test, so I'm a little confused about how that happened. The town, the black community in town was organized by William Randall, a big physical man and a powerful presence in the town who owned one of two black newspapers in Macon. And I have some recollection that one of our guys, Joel Siegel, who ended up doing movie reviews on ABC television and died a number of years ago, and Bill Randall somehow negotiated registering without a literacy test. But that could be a very faulty memory. But by my count, by our count, we registered 1,750 people.
Wow, that's great.
And there was an election as we left. Reverend Moon, who was the town barber in the black community, ran for the water board and got in a runoff election.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't end up winning, but boy, that was a big deal. And,
yeah.
And back in the lower.
Yeah, and since that time, I know Macon still has its ups and downs, but there's, you know, I felt that we were part of something that got the, we didn't get the ball rolling, but we gave, our presence gave it a push. Mm-hmm. And I felt very good about that. I know that everybody in our group did. And for me personally, I went on to be part of the draft resistance movement and the anti-war movement. I was the editor of the Bruin at UCLA. And
mm-hmm. One minute.
I had a career of being involved in things. And if nothing else, being in Macon gave me a lot of confidence to take on the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would have had it. Other than that, I don't know if Martin Luther King came to UCLA and announced SCOPE there, and it was not he didn't make a fiery church sermon speech. He made a very well-reasoned intellectual argument for taking action now, and boy, that got me. When I was 19 years old, I was at the end of my sophomore year, and I said, I'm going. I said, right there, I'm going. And you know, it started a lot of things in my life, and in that sense, it was a very successful experience for me.
Great.
My name is Joan Connolly, and I worked in Williamsburg County in rural Virginia. And I came from a small Catholic women's college in Boston. I was 19, and I just came on my own. It was not a real popular thing at my school at that point to be involved in this kind of work. And I had found out about the project because I had come to Atlanta in April of 1965, a part of a group of students from Boston who actually worked in the SCLC office gearing up for the summer scope project. So that's how I had heard about it. Two things that I would say about Lorenberg County that I haven't heard, so just thinking of something original. First of all, the leadership in Lorenberg County was very well organized and able to, had worked real hard to set things up for us. So there were five scope people who came to Lorenberg County, and they had recruited many families, so we all had places to stay and moved pretty regularly. Probably the longest we stayed with the family would have been 2 weeks, and we were all there for that summer, and then some of us came back the next summer. The second thing is that there were three different groups that were working that we all had to figure out how to work together. There were two women from Virginia Student Civil Rights Organization, VSCRC. There were the five of us from SCOPE, and then the strong, real leader in the community was an NAACP leader, then in the county and eventually statewide. So there was some interesting politics. The five of us from SCOPE, two were from the North, somebody was from West Virginia, somebody was from Michigan, and somebody was from Oregon. So we were definitely the outsiders, and then the two VSCRC people were native Virginians, in a similar situation to yours. And then Nathaniel Lee Hawthorne, who was the NAACP leader. So everybody came with a slightly different way of thinking and way of approaching. Definitely the SCOPE people were there. We knew we were there to do canvassing and voter registration, and that's what we did all day, every day, all summer long. And I don't know, I would love to know the number of people who were actually registered during that summer. I don't think it was a huge number, but it was certainly people who hadn't been registered before, you know, certainly showed up. Kathy was there too, so I don't want to repeat anything that you've been thinking to say. So
you go.
And as somebody said, the one thing I would say personally is I felt that I took away way more from that experience in terms of influence on my life as anything we could have given during 4 months' time.
Would you please say the name of the county and the state where you were?
Lunenburg County in Virginia.
Lunen?
Lunenburg, Lunenburg.
My name is Kathy Schwartz, and I also was in Lunenburg County. And I was, I had just graduated from nursing school, and I was at Boston College, and that's where Hosea Williams came. Somebody at Boston College organized it, and Hosea Williams came and talked, and I said, well, that's the obvious thing to do, and then it turns out nobody else from BC was going, so. Find the Catholic Interracial Council at the Pella Center, and they actually knew Joan. They said, oh, I know somebody who's in the same situation, so I'll hook you up, so you can go down together, and we ended up in the pool down there. But Lunenburg County, I think as Joan said, Nathaniel Lee Hawthorne, he was the man in charge. And while voter registration was what we were doing, he had a big agenda. And during the time that we were there, the two summers, there was voter registration, there was the march that SCOPE called. I think you remember SCOPE. I mean, SCLC said there's going to be a march, and we're like, oh, there's going to be a march. And they said, hang on for a second, we're going to talk about that. You know, they said, come present your case, and we'll decide. And you know, they were in charge. So that was, voter registration was going on. Also, school segregation was starting to happen. And so we started a school, like a quote freedom school or whatever, but basically it was for the senior, it was first grade and seniors, and so to give them the opportunity to be with white people as a teacher, give them that experience and that confidence of talking. And we worked with them around certain skills and writing skills and stuff, and we learned a lot about what they had to say. They wrote about their lives and started to, what they were writing in 65, 66 about Vietnam and all of their relatives that was there, that were, the, you know, had been killed or injured or were back. And then the third thing that was on their agenda was a community center. EEOC was soliciting grants from different counties, but it had to be biracial. The grant had to be both black and white, and so scope people, we were sent out to the white people's homes, where basically they would, you know, tell us to get off their property or come out with their shotgun and their dogs or whatever. And so that first year, that was not successful to get the grant. But in fact, the second year, like I think probably by 67, they were successful. And I'll just iterate what Joan said, that I feel like I learned so much being there. And one of the things that's taken me through everything that I've done is a sense of what white privilege is, and a sense of what black people faced every day that we faced, but in a way we knew that we weren't probably going to get the shit kicked out of us or killed or buried, even though, you know, that had happened.
2 minutes.
But the one real lesson that I had was that there were four of us, two white women, two black women. I was driving. We had to go to another county for a meeting, and we were going home. It was dark, late at night down this dark road, and this truck came by, and there were two men in it, and they pulled up in front of us, and then they turned around. So we decided to turn around and go back to the Four Corners, and they were there, and that at the stoplight, the guy, you know, he had his gun, and so we're like, there was a restaurant there, so we went to the color part of the restaurant. They went to the white side, and they stood outside. And I put our lives in jeopardy, being this naive white girl from the North, and I said, I'm calling the police. And I called the police, and I said, then blah, 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 and get yourself here. And they came, and I said, blah, 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 and they said, well, we can't do anything about that. And I said, well, you have to escort us home. And he said, we can only take you to the county line. And I said, fine. And I thought, it's a miracle that we're alive.
Yes, it is.
It's a miracle. So that was like...
That's amazing.
You asserted your rights.
Whoa!
With hindsight, you wouldn't
have... We were all stupid, weren't we?
Oh, man. That is out there. I have not heard a story like that. That's amazing.
I'm Carol Colmus, and I was Carol Johnson at that time. I pretty much said the things that I wanted to say, but I realized that I first went to Macon, and I actually did stay in Macon, as I remember, but I worked with someone named Jim Bullock, who came and got me each day, and we went to Gray, Georgia, in Jones County. And the main thing I remember from that is just that his jobs was to interview this black man who'd been beaten up by some white men and for the FBI. And so that was a very impactful experience for me, going through that interview. And we did register people to vote, but I don't have any idea what came of it. So anyway, that's all.
That's great. And oh, I'm sorry. Did you? Yeah. Well, you were here first, so you go ahead.
Oh, I have nothing to say. I'm just an observer.
You're an observer. Yeah. Okay. Alrighty.
Bill.
My name is Bill Trainer.
I know you're Bill Trainer, I just talked to you.
And I worked for SCLC on and off for about, over about a three-year period. And I was in Crawfordsville, Georgia a couple of times and had a lot of very interesting experiences there. Home of Alexander Stevens, the Vice President of the Confederacy. And spent the Scope summer in Newberry, South Carolina. And prior to that, in the spring, I went with J.T. Johnson, who has been here. Mm-hmm. And I thought we drove 10,000 miles all over Colorado, Pacific Northwest, whatever, recruiting. He says, he just told me lunch, it was 15,000 miles.
Wow.
But it was a hell of a lot of driving. And we recruited some of the people who are here now. And said I went and got a million stories, of course. And then I worked on the Poor People's Campaign in Resurrection City in D.C., and I ran something called the Poor People's University. It sounded very impressive, but it was a little dinky little program on the side of Resurrection City.
It had a
Jose vision, that's right. And so I really got a lot out of it. And then one of the things that I learned in the South, which kind of set the course of most of my career, is I learned how to be a youth worker. I learned how to work with groups of these teenage kids in North Garfordsville and Newberry and elsewhere. You know, they were the troops that, at least in my experience, you didn't have good luck picketing if you didn't have the teenagers, because frankly, the adults weren't about to march up and down in the hot sun or whatever it was called for. And so I started later a shelter for runaway kids and whatever, and went on and did different things in youth work. The last 20 years, I published a national newspaper that covered children and youth issues. But I really got a hell of a lot out of working for SCLC. I really did. Oh, and I was a student at Georgetown, and Stoney Cook came up to Georgetown, and he knew Father Richard McSorley, a Jesuit there, and he plugged me in with Stoney, and that's how when I came here, I hitchhiked here, and I didn't know one single solitary person. And I walked in the house, this is my last story.
Right.
I walked in the house, no one knew me from a hole. The place was an absolute wreck. Mm-hmm. A wreck. Trash cans, food on the floor. I mean, Big Lester was back there cooking pig's feet and whatever. And, you know, I didn't. But I had been in the Army for 3 years before that. So I just jumped in there and started cleaning up this place, taking out the trash and everything. Well, within 2 or 3 days, I was the greatest guy on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, you were. Well, I have a proposition, brothers and sisters, for our group. If theoretically, we're going to end at 3:30, but we know deep in our hearts that the other groups are not going to end at 3:30. We are supposed to go back to the ballroom and give a report back. And what I have found, I was a professional consultant and facilitator for all of my professional career, working primarily with diverse groups and on racial issues, and fundraising in diverse communities and teaching and exchanging that information. What I found is really works well in a large group. Instead of me reporting back on what you said, I want to throw this out, and we can role play it right now, and you can change your mind later. But when we give our report back from our group, which is supposed to take only 5 minutes, but we know people will take whatever time they take, and then it's going to be followed by a memorial circle where we call out the names of the people we want to remember, is that we go around now and try to keep it within 1 minute, which would make our section 12 minutes, so that would be perfectly decent, which is a lasting highlight for me is, and you can either do it preferably in the present tense, and going forward, you know, from this reunion, what I'm going to do or continue to do is, and I would like that to be our group report, rather than me try to consolidate all the things that you said. I think that's the real value of this reunion. And so I would like to model that briefly, is that a highlight of this reunion for me is how forthcoming everybody has been. We have not seen each other in, you know, many of us haven't in 50 years, and people are have that circle of trust, the brothers and sisters in circle of trust. And going forward, I will really remember what Bernard Lafayette cautioned us: when I am speaking to young people, I will ask the questions and stop doing so much giving the lecture. Mm-hmm. So that's my highlight, and that's what I got here this weekend and going to carry forward.
Well, I think the most interesting thing for me is to realize how much harder an awful lot of people had in other parts of the South than I had in Newberry. I mean, okay, maybe it wasn't, you know, we weren't in Fat City or anything, but we only had one of our people got mugged. There were five of us, I think, and others had much worse experiences. And I really very respectful of what they did.
I said earlier that I had spent a long time being relatively quiet and sharing that sense of guilt leaving a place 40, 50 years ago and not ever returning and wondering what happened. One thing happened this time, and I'll really try and make it brief, that really made this weekend worth coming. And that was, I was sitting with Bruce having lunch, and he asked how I ended up at Scope. And I said, well, a bunch of us kids at this college where I went in Northern Ohio went up to try and close down a hammer mill, paper mill company before the Selma conflagration occurred in March. And we went up and we actually blocked all the railroad trains, and it made them shut down the ovens for the trees and stuff. And it ended up being a big deal, and their board of trustees met with us. And so we closed down hammer mill for a little while. And I said, but, you know, I was a freshman in college, and I never heard anything of that, but I met C.T. Vivian because he flew up once we got Hammer Mill shut down.
So, unfortunately, it's going to be a little longer.
Well, it's going to be real quick. Okay. And then I'm just going to say, I met C.T. Vivian, and he sent me here.
Great.
Bruce said, by the way, right after that, Hammer Mill pulled out of Selma and did not build their plant.
So one way you might consider sharing that in the larger circle is... Mm-hmm. I was involved in a strike at Hammer Mill. It turned out to be successful. It led to me being recruited to Scope, but, and that's why I'm here.
But I didn't even know it was successful.
But so that's what you got. That's what your highlight is. You learned this weekend that something you did so long ago was 50 years.
I think for me the highlight was hearing the stories of everyone else, because I think I left that summer wondering if I had done anything that was worth having done. And had been hurt, and was it, had anything good come from this? And I think for many years, I kind of wondered that and just sort of didn't talk about it until I was told about the reunion and began to meet many of you by email, and now having the chance to meet you here. And I think for me, it's freed me up now to remember it, and remembering it freely, to share it with other people.
Great,
thank you. I think for me that I've been really impressed with the fact that, yes, we did very valuable work. We did great work. What things we didn't accomplish, we still accomplished a lot. But I am brought further and further into the concept of, yes, our main goal was twofold: voter registration, but also education. And I take the political education in the broadest way. And now I feel really, really very strongly that we must encourage the next generation and do as much as we can to press on with voter registration. It's being decimated.
Right.
It's been going on for decades now, and we really need the push again, and also with education. And you know, to encourage people, to keep young people, keep asking questions, keep challenging. Don't just believe one source. Don't just believe one person. Advocate for yourself. But I also think, too, that nonviolence is still a very, very powerful method of change.
Yeah. I'm Jim Herman. As far as what this has turned out to mean for me is, there was no way that I could expect this much joy. I mean, it's just been interesting to get those 50-year-old memory bubbles popping out. I would say this, and then I'll pass it on. It resulted in my career decision. I wound up working for the federal government and was able to pursue a job that was as closely related to the volunteer kind of stuff. So I worked in the Office of Federal Contract Compliance for 30 years, basically. It was a little more complicated than that because we got shifted around different places. But affirmative action programs is what we enforced. And so that was very rewarding career, and of course more lucrative. The other thing though, I mean, who would have thought after 50 years, you know, I mean, just that whole idealism of that time to be, have a chance. And my wife got tired of these stories a long time ago when she glasses over, you know, but here you can say all those things and feel good about it. Neat, I'm glad you have it.
I'm Kathy Deppe. I think this renewed my sense of hope because look at what's happened in the last 50 years and the wars and the, you know, we've been in eternal wars and now we've lost a good part of the Voting Rights Act that we fought for. But it renewed my sense of hope because I see, I have a better picture of what really we accomplished through our experience in that movement. We thought, you know, we could change the world at 19 and 20. Mm-hmm. We were going to fix it. The old folks had made a real mess of it, hadn't they? Mm-hmm. You know, we were going to fix it. And then we didn't, you know. And then it was kind of a, now what? You know, we're 60, 70, 75 years old. But I feel that we did open some doors, and especially for ourselves. But we did open some doors through what we did. And the struggle continues. And we have to renew our push for democracy. And we have to fight for the Voting Rights Act all over again, but I do it now with a renewed sense of hope.
Neil Reichland here. One memory that's kept coming up for me throughout this whole experience is it was either we had a restaurant in Macon that we integrated in the sense that they wouldn't serve white people, and they said, no, we have to serve the black people, we don't have to serve you. Or it was in America, so it could have been in either one. But we had a meeting in a church, and Hosea said he wanted everybody to take out anything that can be construed as a weapon. They passed a hat, and we sang songs, and, you know, it had combs in it and toothpicks and every pocket knives. But the power of going out and taking something on, nonviolently, The feeling that is coming up every now is just so powerful, mm-hmm. and I will always carry that with me.
Thank you.
I'll pass.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that stands out for me in this reunion is hearing people who have continued working directly in civil rights work. Many of us, including myself, have done labor organizing and anti-war work. But to hear the stories of what how people are, you know, there's a lot of talk about how do we connect with the youth, how do we connect with the movement that's going on now, how do we tell people about the story of the civil rights movement from 65, or 60, 55, whenever. Is hearing people's stories of how they're doing it.
And Joy, this is the granddaughter of some people who kept a Freedom House in Wilcox. Their story is in my book, but I want you to just speak. For you as a granddaughter whose father and grandfather and grandmother were deeply involved, how has this reunion affected you? Just a few words.
I know it's going to be something amazing because this whole process of connecting with Maria and this is way after my grandparents had passed away, and I had wanted to gather stories for my family, for my nieces and my great-nephews, and this has been an amazing time for me to reflect on their bravery, your bravery. I know many of you don't look at yourselves as being courageous or brave, but many folks in my generation say, could I have done this at 18 or 19? And of course, we feel like, I know coming up in my household, based on my grandparents, I feel like I could have.
Yeah.
I would have done it. But you do think about that. And the mere fact that you all were on your college campuses, you got the call, and despite your family members, despite some of you not even having relationships with them any longer, you felt a bigger calling. And for that, I am extremely grateful. For that, I am here in representation of my grandparents who would have been here. And for that, I'm here because of Maria Gittin, who decided to tell their story along with other families, who gave life to a part of the movement that was lost that particular summer in 1965, which I was just barely a year old. I was born August of 64, so thank you. This is extremely life-changing for me, this whole journey that Maria and I have been on, and I wish you well, and I know nothing but the best is coming your way, because you shared a part of your life that you could have said, no, I'll do something else, it's too big for me, but you followed a deeper calling. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Comas. I think that this week, or these days, have allowed me to reclaim myself and who I was 50 years ago. And you've all jarred my memories, and you've all totally helped me remember and appreciate not only you and what you did around me, but my own family for being so supportive of me. And anyway, thank you.
Thank you. And